Chapter 71. You take it smoothly now, said I, but you were very serious last night, when you swore it was death. And so I swear it is death, said he, putting his pipe back in his mouth, and death by the rope, in the open street not far from this, and it's serious, that you should fully understand it to be so. What then, when that's once done? Here I am. To go back now, ud be as bad as to stand ground worse. Besides, Pip, I'm here, because I've meant it by you, years and years. As to what I dare, I'm a old bird now, as has dared all manner of traps since first he was fledged, and I'm not afeard to perch upon a scarecrow. If there's death hid inside of it, there is, and let him come out, and I'll face him, and then I'll believe in him and not afore. And now let me have a look at my gentleman again. Once more, he took me by both hands, and surveyed me with an air of admiring proprietorship, smoking with great complacency all the while. It appeared to me that I could do no better than secure him some quiet lodging hard by, of which he might take possession when Herbert returned, whom I expected in 2 or 3 days. That the secret must be confided to Herbert as a matter of unavoidable necessity, even if I could have put the immense relief I should derive from sharing it with him out of the question, was plain to me. But it was by no means so plain to Mr. Provis. I resolved to call him by that name, who reserved his consent to Herbert's participation until he should have seen him, and formed a favorable judgment of his physiognomy. And even then, dear boy, said he, pulling a greasy little clasped black testament out of his pocket, we'll have him on his oath. To state that my terrible patron carried this little black book about the world, solely to swear people on in cases of emergency, would be to state what I never quite established, but this I can say, that I never knew him put it to any other use. The book itself had the appearance of having been stolen from some court of justice, and perhaps his knowledge of its antecedents, combined with his own experience in that wise, gave him a reliance on its powers as a sort of legal spell or charm. On this first occasion of his producing it, I recalled how he had made me swear fidelity in the churchyard long ago, and how he had described himself last night as always swearing to his resolutions in his solitude. As he was at present dressed in a seafaring slop suit, in which he looked as if he had some parrots and cigars to dispose of, I next discussed with him what dress he should wear. He cherished an extraordinary belief in the virtues of shorts as a disguise, and had in his own mind sketched a dress for himself that would have made him something between a dean and a dentist. It was with considerable difficulty that I won him over to the assumption of a dress more like a prosperous farmer's, and we arranged that he should cut his hair close, and wear a little powder. Lastly, as he had not yet been seen by the laundress or her niece, he was to keep himself out of their view until his change of dress was made. It would seem a simple matter to decide on these precautions, but in my dazed, not to say distracted, state, it took so long that I did not get out to further them until 2 or 3 in the afternoon. He was to remain shut up in the chambers while I was gone, and was on no account to open the door. There being to my knowledge a respectable lodging house in Essex Street, the back of which looked into the temple, and was almost within hail of my windows, I first of all repaired to that house, and was so fortunate as to secure the second floor for my uncle, Mr. Provis. I then went from shop to shop, making such purchases as were necessary to the change in his appearance. This business transacted, I turned my face, on my own account, to Little Britain. Mr. Jaggers was at his desk, but, seeing me enter, got up immediately, and stood before his fire. Now, Pip, said he, be careful. I will, sir, I returned. For, coming along I had thought well, of what I was going to say. Don't commit yourself, said Mr. Jaggers, and don't commit anyone. You understand anyone? Don't tell me anything. I don't want to know anything. I am not curious. Of course I saw that he knew the man was come. I merely want, Mr. Jaggers, said I, to assure myself that what I have been told is true. I have no hope of its being untrue, but at least I may verify it. Mr. Jaggers nodded. But did you say told or informed? He asked me, with his head on one side, and not looking at me, but looking in a listening way at the floor. Told would seem to imply verbal communication. You can't have verbal communication with a man in New South Wales, you know. I will say, informed, Mr. Jaggers. Good. I have been informed by a person named Abel Magwitch, that he is the benefactor so long unknown to me. That is the man, said Mr. Jaggers, in New South Wales. And only he? Said one. And only he, said Mr. Jaggers. I am not so unreasonable, sir, as to think you at all responsible for my mistakes and wrong conclusions, but I always supposed it was Miss Havisham. As you say, Pip, returned Mr. Jaggers, turning his eyes upon me coolly, and taking a bite at his forefinger, I am not at all responsible for that. And yet it looked so like it, sir, I pleaded with a downcast heart. Not a particle of evidence, Pip, said Mr. Jaggers, shaking his head and gathering up his skirts. Take nothing on its looks, take everything on evidence. There's no better rule. I have no more to say, said I, with a sigh, after standing silent for a little while. I have verified my information, and there's an end. And Magwitch in New South Wales having at last disclosed himself, said Mr. Jaggers, you will comprehend, Pip, how rigidly throughout my communication with you, I have always adhered to the strict line of fact. There has never been the least departure from the strict line of fact. You are quite aware of that? Quite, sir. I communicated to Magwitch in New South Wales, when he first wrote to me from New South Wales the caution, that he must not expect me ever, to deviate from the strict line of fact. I also communicated to him another caution. He appeared to me to have obscurely hinted in his letter at some distant idea he had of seeing you in England here. I cautioned him, that I must hear no more of that. That he was not at all likely to obtain a pardon, that he was expatriated for the term of his natural life, and that his presenting himself in this country would be an act of felony, rendering him liable to the extreme penalty of the law. I gave Magwitch that caution, said Mr. Jaggers, looking hard at me. I wrote it to New South Wales. He guided himself by it, no doubt. No doubt, said one. I have been informed by Wemmick, pursued Mr. Jaggers, still looking hard at me, that he has received a letter, under date Portsmouth, from a colonist of the name of Purvis, or Provis, I suggested. Or Provis, thank you, Pip. Perhaps it is Provis? Perhaps you know it's Provis? Yes, said one. You know it's Provis. A letter, under date Portsmouth. From a colonist of the name of Provis, asking for the particulars of your address, on behalf of Magwitch. Wemmick sent him the particulars, I understand, by return of post. Probably it is through Provis, that you have received the explanation of Magwitch in New South Wales? It came through Provis, I replied. Good day, Pip, said Mr. Jaggers, offering his hand. Glad to have seen you. In writing by post to Magwitch in New South Wales, or in communicating with him through Provis, have the goodness to mention that the particulars and vouchers of our long account shall be sent to you, together with the balance, for there is still a balance remaining. Good day, Pip. We shook hands, and he looked hard at me, as long as he could see me. I turned at the door, and he was still looking hard at me, while the two vile casts on the shelf seemed to be trying to get their eyelids open, and to force out of their swollen throats, oh, what a man he is. Wemmick was out, and though he had been at his desk he could have done nothing for me. I went straight back to the temple, where I found the terrible Provis drinking rum and water and smoking negro head, in safety. Next day the clothes I had ordered, all came home, and he put them on. Whatever he put on, became him less, it dismally seemed to me, than what he had worn before. to my thinking, there was something in him that made it hopeless to attempt to disguise him. The more I dressed him, and the better I dressed him, the more he looked like a slouching fugitive on the marshes. This effect on my anxious fancy was partly referable, no doubt, to his old face and manner growing more familiar to me, but I believe too, that he dragged one of his legs, as if there were still a weight of iron on it, and that from head to foot there was convict in the very grain of the man. The influences of his solitary hut life were upon him besides, and gave him a savage air that no dress could tame. Added to these, were the influences of his subsequent branded life among men, and, crowning all, his consciousness that he was dodging and hiding now. In all his ways of sitting and standing, and eating and drinking, of brooding about, in a high-shouldered reluctant style of taking out his great horn-handled jackknife and wiping it on his legs, and cutting his food, of lifting light glasses and cups to his lips, as if they were clumsy pannikins, of chopping a wedge off his bread, and soaking up with it the last fragments of gravy round and round his plate, as if to make the most of an allowance, and then drying his finger ends on it, and then swallowing it in these ways, and a thousand other small nameless instances arising every minute. In the day, there was prisoner, felon, bondsman, plain as plain could be. It had been his own idea to wear that touch of powder, and I had conceded the powder after overcoming the shorts. But I can compare the effect of it, when on, to nothing but the probable effect of rouge upon the dead. So awful was the manner in which everything in him, that it was most desirable to repress, started through that thin layer of pretense, and seemed to come blazing out at the crown of his head. It was abandoned, as soon as tried, and he wore his grizzled hair cut short. Words cannot tell what a sense I had, at the same time, of the dreadful mystery that he was to me. When he fell asleep of an evening, with his knotted hands clenching the sides of the easy chair, and his bald head tattooed with deep wrinkles falling forward on his breast, I would sit, and look at him, wondering what he had done, and loading him with all the crimes in the calendar, until the impulse was powerful on me to start up and fly from him. Every hour so increased my abhorrence of him, that I even think I might have yielded to this impulse in the first agonies of being so haunted, notwithstanding all he had done for me, and the risk he ran, but for the knowledge that Herbert must soon come back. Once, I actually did start out of bed in the night, and begin to dress myself in my worst clothes, hurriedly intending to leave him there with everything else I possessed, and enlist for India as a private soldier. I doubt if a ghost could have been more terrible to me, up in those lonely rooms in the long evenings and long nights, with the wind and the rain always rushing by. A ghost could not have been taken and hanged on my account, and the consideration that he could be, and the dread that he would be, were no small addition to my horrors. When he was not asleep, or playing a complicated kind of patience with a ragged pack of cards of his own, a game that I never saw before or since, and in which he recorded his winnings by sticking his jackknife into the table, when he was not engaged in either of these pursuits, he would ask me to read to him foreign language, dear boy. While I complied, he, not comprehending a single word, would stand before the fire surveying me with the air of an exhibitor, and I would see him, between the fingers of the hand with which I shaded my face, appealing in dumb show to the furniture, to take notice of my proficiency. The imaginary student pursued by the misshapen creature he had impiously made, was not more wretched than I, pursued by the creature who had made me, and recoiling from him with a stronger repulsion, the more he admired me, and the fonder he was of me. This is written of, I am sensible, as if it had lasted a year. It lasted about 5 days. Expecting Herbert all the time, I dared not go out, except when I took provis for an airing after dark. At length, one evening when dinner was over, and I had dropped into a slumber quite worn out, for my nights had been agitated, and my rest broken by fearful dreams, I was roused by the welcome footstep on the staircase. Provis, who had been asleep too, staggered up at the noise I made, and in an instant I saw his jackknife shining in his hand. Quiet. It's Herbert, I said, and Herbert came bursting in, with the airy freshness of 600 miles of France upon him. Handel, my dear fellow, how are you, and again how are you, and again how are you? I seem to have been gone a 12-month. Why, so I must have been, for you have grown quite thin and pale. Handel, my halloa, I beg your pardon. He was stopped in his running on, and in his shaking hands with me, by seeing Provis. Provis, regarding him with a fixed attention, was slowly putting up his jackknife, and groping in another pocket for something else. Herbert, my dear friend, said I, shutting the double doors, while Herbert stood staring and wondering, something very strange has happened. This is a visitor of mine. It's all right, dear boy, said Provis coming forward, with his little clasped black book, and then addressing himself to Herbert. Take it in your right hand. Lord strike you dead on the spot, if ever you split in any way soonever. Kiss it. Do so, as he wishes it, I said to Herbert. So, Herbert, looking at me with a friendly uneasiness and amazement, complied, and Provis immediately shaking hands with him, said, Now you're on your oath, you know. And never believe me on mine, if Pip shan't make a gentleman on you. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.